I boycott Bookshop Santa Cruz. I boycott Atlantis Fantasy World. That's not because of specific discrimination against homeless individuals or activists. It is because, although in Stuart Martin's case at the ID building, it is because of discrimination against homeless activists. But these are three of six businesses we targeted because they took a leading role and supported the anti-homeless downtown ordinances of 1994, of April, which make it illegal to sit down on the sidewalk, illegal to ask peacefully for spare change, illegal to have a demonstration that's peaceful at night, let's say with a table downtown. Illegal to put a literature table in front of the of an outdoor cafe, illegal to perform in front of an outdoor cafe. How can that be, you say? You've seen many people performing. That's true, but it is illegal. And so if Neil Coonerty does not like the people performing in front of the Bookshop Santa Cruz cafe, he can have them arrested. So it's at the sufferance of the particular cafe, as Phil Free and Skidmark Bob well know, although I don't think they've ever been arrested under this law. Instead, disturbing the peace is the statute that's been used there. Well, thank you, Sherman, for that update, and hopefully we'll have more of an update on a week from today when we'll learn if something substantive has come out of these Java House conversations. I certainly hope there will be, and I will certainly be the first to report it if something has.
Thank you.
All right. A report from Knoxville now, again off the internet. A letter from Knoxville Fremont Bonds. Knoxville is in Orleans, Tennessee, so we're talking East Coast here. This is what's happening in the East Coast according to the most recent communique. There's a letter from Mike. Just thought I'd let people know what's going on in the Southland. The health department here dropped its lawsuit against Knox Fremont Bonds after three court delays, thanks to our generous lawyer. The health department is now offering to give classes to us on dangerous foods, cleanliness, etc. It's amazing having them work with us, even though we are germ freaks. We do not have to get a permit, though, which is good, since they cost money and we wouldn't get one anyway. We are serving indoors on Saturdays at Volunteer Ministry. It's cool. They have this huge industrial kitchen with some stock food we can use, and we're feeding up to 80 people a week. After some hesitation, think linking up with them is a good idea in terms of connecting with other community groups. They don't make people pray for food, and we still serve outside at Market Square on Sundays to stay visible and then bring leftovers to the ministry. I am of the belief it is cruel to make people eat in the cold when an acceptable enclosure is available. We're broadcasting in this community radio we have, just working on a better antenna. I think we can make affordable transmitters later on. We'll see. Atlanta looks like it's coming together. That's a national gathering in Atlanta of Foodnet Bombs for this year. Anyone heard from Andy from Chattanooga who moved down to Atlanta? If so, let me know. Boycott capitalism, eat the rich, Mike. And that's a report from Knoxville Foodnet Bombs in Tennessee. I should also mention, regarding free radio, the hearing for free radio has been postponed again to March, and it is not yet on our free radio support rally flyer, but hopefully it will be soon. So the attempt to shut up free radios across the country, starting with Free Radio Berkeley, will be happening in early March, and I believe Santa Cruz, under the leadership of Ed Fry, is also filing a brief in support of the right of free radio stations to broadcast freely, not to, of course, monopolize the airwaves like certain large broadcasters do, not to set, so the FCC cannot set prohibitive fees to do that. The radio airwaves belong to the people, and the people have to reclaim them. Let's go back to Berkeley again, where it looks like some good things continue to happen. I was just about to play Julia Vinograd. She's a poet up there who's written 40 books. I think she's working on her 41st book. I've often played her poetry on the air. She's a remarkable poet. And let's see what her poetry does for you today.
And Duncan and I chowed down. I'm now on the streets with the famous Berkeley poet, Julia Vinograd. Julia, hello.
I'm going to read a poem called Horn on the Street. A horn moans and shudders, writhing like a snake shedding its skin. Music groans bright as blood. Nobody calls a doctor or even stops to catch the spilling sounds. They might be contagious. They're definitely not insured. The musician crouched behind his horn has nowhere to go for the night. The night crouched behind the musician has nowhere to go. Go away fast as love is gone, the song says, before night follows you home. Better not get involved. The musician crouched behind his horn hasn't eaten for so long his stomach's shrunk. He's forgotten he's hungry. But the night crouched behind the musician licks its lips, smiling. The horn plays a pet name you haven't been called in so long. Go away fast as love is gone, the song says. You can't be helped anymore.
There you are. Any other poetry you want to read for us at this moment? Here's another one.
Loiterer. He hides in a tarot deck when the cops come by. They don't want him, but they also don't want him around. He hides under the magician's table and steals some wine from the cop. There's a price for that wine, but he'd pay it anyway. Or he'll hide in hell behind the cardboard flame, sticking out a grubby, spare-changing hand to whosoever's fortune is being read. Nobody sees. Nobody ever sees. He knows why the world ended, and anyone who says it's still going on is just slow. They'll learn. He doesn't talk to himself anymore. He got tired of listening. He's got a habit of clutching his skinny elbows hard, as if his whole body might blow apart like a tumbleweed in a dust storm. I've seen him at the bottom of the Fool's Cliff, arguing which one of them should jump. He gets around. He smells of shadows. Dogs don't like him. He swam through a bubbling marsh of cement before it became a city. His fingerprints are underfoot forever.
I like it.
Okay.
Thank you, Jill.
That's sort of more your wavelength than that stuff I gave you before, but these are more recent.
I think it's all pretty good, and we played your last stuff on the radio, and people liked it. So.
They did? No kidding. Well, thank them for me.
Well, you can thank them yourself.
Okay, thanks, people.
Thanks, Julia.
And that was a brief set of poems from Julia. I think we may actually have another poem. Let me see.
My name is Fred Martin. How are you?
Fred.
Actually, no, that's Fred Martin. Let's play him. He's a protester who arrived in town in Brooklyn and set up shop on the street, somewhat like one time Dave Jacobs used to do here in Santa Cruz. He was making a large banner right outside the large kind of empty lot, which used to contain the Berkeley Inn at Haston Telegraph, which was a low-income hotel that was disappeared in a mysterious arson fire, which many blamed on the owner in the mid-80s, and has not been replaced with any kind of affordable housing.
I'm Robert Norris. It's about 8:30 on January 17th out here at Haston Telegraph in Berkeley.
Yeah.
And we have a banner you're making here which reads...
Right now I ain't got it completely finished, but what it's going to read is, we the people are the ones that they throw behind the bars. And then it's going to go something like this, but not exactly sure. Why not the crooked politicians, judges, lawyers, and cops? We have already spent the money to build the cells, fill them up.
Home for the true criminals, eh?
Yeah, they are the true criminals. I mean, they bring in the dope. They make that methamphetamines. And by the feds, I mean, they set up heroin processing plants under Bush from the CIA in, I think, what was it, Cambodia? Or something like that, Thailand. And they just, Oliver North was bringing in cocaine to trade for ours. I mean, if it had been me or you, we'd been in jail for the rest of our lives.
Now, how long have you been here in Berkeley?
I've been here in Berkeley about 3 weeks now, 3.5 weeks.
And where are you from?
I'm from Live Oak, Florida.
And recently, or?
Actually, I left Florida, went up to New Jersey, from Jersey to Portland, Portland to Sacramento, from Sacramento to here. And I'm a protester. I do it several different places. I do it also behind the White House in D.C.
When was your last protest?
A year and a half ago, behind the White House in D.C., legalization of marijuana. And there, it's a lot different than here. You got the Secret Service and stuff, and you're always on the camera. Here, you're always on the camera, but you don't know where it's coming from.
So you've been here for 3 weeks. Have you been sleeping out?
Yeah, I sleep on the, I'm a street person. If you're a protester, like in D.C., you're there 24 hours a day. because it's a permanent sign and it's a certain size and shape and dimension that you can have it as.
Now, there was a permanent protest across from the White House. Is that still going on?
Yes, it's anti-nuclear, and Ellen and I can't think of their names right. Thomas are the ones, and it's anti-nuclear, and there's a lady that's still there. She shows the pictures of the Holocaust, not the Holocaust, but the bombs of Hiroshima and Nagasaki. She has pictures of that up on bulletin boards and stuff, and she hands out literature about it. As far as I know, I haven't been there in a year and a half, and they closed off Pennsylvania Avenue so the traffic wouldn't go by and see the signs no more.
And is it still closed off?
It's still closed off as far as I know, because I haven't heard in the news or in the papers that they opened it again.
Now, have you met any local activists here in your last 3 weeks?
I've met quite a few of them so far, because I was not even planning on protesting here. But I was over in People's Park sleeping one night, or actually in the daytime, and it sort of got dark. Three cops come up on top of me, and I was under my blanket, and they ID'd me, and I had a bong on me, and also a butcher knife that was in my saddlebags. Well, they searched me because my bong was out in plain sight and stuff after I pulled off my blanket, and they took my bong. They asked me if they could search my saddlebags. I said, sure, go ahead. They searched my saddlebags, and they found a butcher knife. They gave me a ticket for my butcher knife, and I had to go to court. Well, the DA dropped the charges when I went to before I went to court.
Did they confiscate your knife?
They confiscated my knife and my bong also.
Did you get your knife back?
No, I had to file a piece of paper with the clerk in order to go back in front of the judge, because without a judge's order, you can't get your property back.
And did you get that judge's order?
I have to go Friday at 1 o'clock to court to get the judge's order.
So how are you making your sandwiches without your knife?
Huh?
How are you making your sandwiches without your knife?
Well, I can't. Actually, right now I'm on a 7-day fast. I ain't doing it because of the protests. It's just clean my own system out.
Uh-huh.
But, they say that anything, it's more or less a game. If they take anything off of you, most people won't go through the paperwork to get it back. And they say, well, this is a nice buck knife or a nice Pima knife. I think I'll take this one home with me.
Uh-huh.
Because they're not afraid of somebody actually going down there and requesting it back.
Have you heard of this happening, or both harassment for sleeping and seizure of property to anyone else in Berkeley recently?
Well, I got my first trespassing ticket when I was down at Willard Pool waiting to take a shower on Saturday morning. I was just sleeping out in front of it. I wasn't hurting nothing. I got a ticket, and it's $130 if you get a ticket for sleeping on city property.
Have you gone back in to challenge that, or have you been to a trial?
Well, I have went over there. I have to go over there before 9 or at 12 so I can be in court at 1. But I will be going back to fight it, because I am not paying $130 to a government that passes law for people like me, and actually people like you. You might have a house now, but the way the country's going, you might be out here too in a matter of a few weeks or a few months. You never can tell.
Now, what about people around you here in Berkeley? Are you finding they're getting a lot of tickets?
Well, if they want to give you a ticket, they give you a ticket. If they don't want to, it's like, it's not everybody gets a ticket. Like, every one of these stores here has a no trespassing sign in front of it. And if the cop woke up on the wrong side of the bed one morning, he might give everybody that sits out up next to the building a trespassing ticket. That's $130.
But isn't this public space? These are public sidewalks.
Yeah, they're a public sidewalk, and they also found it, and the federal judge has ordered the signs in these businesses against human rights. Well, it's actually against the law.
Now, I know the judge has ordered the Proposition O, which is a law that makes it illegal to sit in front of shops, put that law on hold. But I think that there is still an easement that shops have in this town, which enables, for example, a store like Cody's to declare that you cannot sit in front of their windows without their permission. It has nothing to do with the city law, but it has to do with their so-called property rights.
But that actually was not in fact the case, according to attorney Beauvais, who I spoke to later, the civil rights attorney in Berkeley, who's taken a number of these cases. He pointed out that the public property extends all the way up to the building and so you cannot harass people for sitting there legally. Though apparently that seems to be Cody's practice, so there's a dispute. Cody's is the large bookstore at Haste and Telegraph, which in the 60s was quite liberal and supportive of anti-war movements and countercultural movements, but under new ownership has been much less so. Speaking of Berkeley, there's a long-standing controversy that I feel I owe our listenership some discussion of here in the last 20 minutes of Bath Robespierre's Broadsides, the show you're listening to on Free Radio Santa Cruz, 96.3 FM. And in case you want to call in, I remind you, the call-in number is 427-3772. That's the situation with the slap suit at People's Park. University of California, in an attempt to quash protest, singled out four activists who were members of the Community Defense Inc., the Community Defense Incorporated group that was alerting the community to the seizure and sequestering of public land that was being done by the university, which was driving out homeless and poor people and setting up these ritzy sports courts, such as the Sand Redwood Volleyball Court that is due to be torn down now if the City Council's proposal, which I talked to you about earlier, is accepted by the Regents. In fact, people themselves are volunteering to tear down that court in a month in a special celebration. There was a lawsuit that was filed against four defendants, one of whom died, Bob Sparks, one of whom has sort of disappeared, Mike Lee, and one of whom finally withdrew from the lawsuit, Dave Nadell. The one remaining defendant is Carol Denny, who is again represented by the same attorney I mentioned before, who is also my attorney in my Ferdinand Bombs case. His name is David Beauvais. I call him Bedrock Beauvais of Berkeley. However, a split developed in the movement up in Berkeley between Dave Nadell and Carol Denny, and it finally hit the papers, I guess, a week ago, and I guess I'll read you that article simply for the historical record. It's not completely accurate, but it does give you something of an overview. It's called Falling Out Among Comrades, and it's in the East Bay Express. Sticks and Stones is the column it appears in, and it's by Paul Rauber. He's the reporter, R-A-U-B-E-R. Just as the City of Berkeley and the University of California seem to be nearing an agreement to preserve People's Park as an open space, if not the countercultural haven it has been for 26 years, a lamentable dispute over what else, money, has sundered People's Park activists Carol Denny and David Nadell. Nadell has appropriated their collective defense fund. Denny is forbidden from appearing in Nadell's Ashkenaz nightclub, and Nadell refuses to speak to her. Needless to say, the solidarity all parties pledged when their legal adventures began 4 years ago is a thing of the past. The stage for the present ugliness was set in December 1994 when Superior Court Judge James Lambden granted summary judgment to the university in its suit against the pair, along with Mike Lee and the late Bob Sparks, over their protests against the construction of volleyball courts in the park. While fining against the protesters and joining them from installing porta-potties and strewing roses, Lambden pointedly failed to award the university any monetary damages, requests for which had fluctuated over the years from $10,000 to $500,000. Had the university been granted substantial monetary damages, it could well have resulted in the loss of Nadell's club. Denny was eager to appeal the decision, fearing that not doing so would prejudice their appeal chances in a separate case that she regarded as more important. In that second case, Denny and Nadell had sued various university officials for defamation after having been accused in official news releases of participating in intimidation and violence. In a remarkable ruling in October 1994, a three-judge panel threw out the suit, ruling that Denny and Nadell were public figures and that the university essentially was in the role of a private citizen and thus unable to libel them, short of the high standard of making deliberate false statements and reckless disregard of the truth. In other words, I interrupt Paul Rauber's article, it's okay for the University of California, a billion-dollar corporation or multi-million-dollar corporation, to slander and smear you to death if you're one of its critics, and you cannot sue them for libel because somehow you become a public figure and they, a government, in essence a government organization, are being treated as private citizens. It was a ridiculous decision which Denny is sought to appeal. And it was by this judge who is in essence one of the kind of a paid university stooge, a guy named Lambden. Lambden's decision 2 months later was at least, I continue with the article reading from Paul Rauber, Lambden's decision 2 months later was at least a partial victory, but By then, the doe had apparently had enough. Relieved of the threat to his club, he was only too happy to declare a draw and retire from the case. The other defendants accepted Nadell's decision, but were surprised when he wrote himself a check for $5,800 from the group's collective defense fund, the balance remaining in the account. Nadell claims he was merely recovering the $6,000 of seed money that he put into the fund in the first place. "I can and will prove that it was my money," he wrote to a third party. Nadell has not responded to Sticks and Stones inquiries by press time. Things went downhill from there. Nadell's letter accuses Denny of calling him a thief. She vigorously denies doing so. He has declared her persona non grata at the Ashkenaz and also refuses to share the mailing list the defendants developed, although the matter may be moot, as the state Supreme Court has rejected Denny's petition for a hearing in the defamation case. Most out of luck in the whole matter is David Beauvais, the local attorney who represented the activists and was still owed some of his fees. Denny insists that she bears Nadell no ill will. "Being sued can completely disorient a person," she said. "I wish the world had lots more Nadells and look forward to working with him cooperatively in the future." At this point, that looks pretty unlikely. And then there was a correction in this week's East Bay Express. In the Sticks and Stones column of January 12th, Paul Roberts stated that David Nadell had appropriated the Collective Defense Fund, where money raised for the Ashkenaz Defense Fund had been deposited. Neither Paul Roberts nor the Express meant to judge whether Mr. Nadell's action was appropriate or not. The bank account from which the money was drawn had belonged to Mr. Nadell prior to his legal dispute with the University of California, and the amount removed was equal to the amount that had been in the account originally. Mr. Nadell also states that no fees are owed him by David Beauvais, attorney for the Ashkenaz Defense Fund. "We apologize to Nadell for any damage that may have been done to his good name or to the good name of his business, the Ashkenaz Music and Dance Club. What, you may ask, does all this mean to any of us down here? Why am I reading you this article?" Well, these two activists are both friends of mine, and this split developed between them up in Berkeley, and I was really asked by one of them to take sides in this issue, and actually fell out with one of them because I did not want to take the side that person wanted me to take. I don't know how many people have been following this controversy. We've had our factional splits here in Santa Cruz as well. I just want to see us getting together to move forward towards broader objectives that we need to move forward to, such as, for instance, police review. That was a very good example of a local split in Santa Cruz. I was barred from Coalition for a Citizen Police Review Board meetings by co-chairperson Margaret Moore. And when Simba Kenyatta was the co-chair, he declined to bring up the issue pointedly and make sure that I and other activists who were barred were admitted. That was too bad. That was sad. We all really had the same objectives, and it was too bad that some of us were excluded. I want to see that doesn't happen in the future. And kind of taking off on that theme about police review, let me play you a brief interview by Gary Yamane, or Yamane, actually, who's the Citizen Police Review Board staff person here in Santa Cruz. I kind of maybe set the theme for our next show, where we can do more police review, because that is an important subject, one which we really haven't touched on very much.
Okay, it's kind of a nice Thursday morning. Nice if you're indoors, I guess. I'm on the phone line here with Gary Yamane of the Citizens Police Review Board. Do I have that pronounced right, Gary?
Yamane.
Yamane, I'm glad. All this time you have very, very patiently allowed me to mangle your name in encounter after encounter.
That's right. I used to call you Norris. I used to think you were Robert Norris, but I was informed it's Norris.
Mm-hmm.
So it's not a problem.
Well, as long as you don't call me you lying, scheming, slimy, dirty rat.
Not to your face.
Oh, yeah, right. So, Mr. Yamane, you've been working for, what, a year, a bit longer on the Citizens Police Review Board as the main staff person there.
Correct.
And what's your job?
My job is to assist the board members in the functioning of the board. I interface with city personnel, the police department, the members of the public, and the board.
And I might add, you're very accessible, at least you have been to me, and spent a number of hours over the last months talking to me about the decisions of the board, the workings of the board, trying to help resolve certain questions I've had. I, of course, had a number of long-standing concerns, such as, public access. Can members of the public, for instance, get copies of police reports? And I think we found out indigents cannot without paying some preposterous cost or something. Wasn't that what we discovered when we talked Lieutenant Velasquez?
It's now Lieutenant Velasquez, and I believe that is correct, that there is a fee for the reports, and it's a fee for everybody.
Now that's something that has to be, I think, changed. Indigent people should not have to pay for access to reports that are important for any of the various kinds of work they're doing. It's always been a grievance of mine with respect to city council type stuff, and I think there is some provision for a waiver, at least at the judicial level. I don't know if there's, and there should be at the local level. Just thought I'd throw that in, since we're on the air. There have been a number of controversies that I, at least, have been concerned about. One of them has been the fact that the Citizens Police Review Board takes its legal decisions from the City Council, John Barisone, who is, in my view, a man with a conflict of interest here because, let's say, his office has a conflict of interest because his office also defends the police department from lawsuits. And so you are, in a sense, certainly in a somewhat adversarial position, your board is, with respect to the police department. Can you perhaps tell us a little bit about that?
Well, I haven't noticed that John has had a conflict with anything that he's handled for the board at this point. There have been issues that the board thought that they might want outside legal counsel on. The topic of outside legal counsel was discussed at the January 8th meeting of the board. It's the board's understanding that the city council is taking action on this.
Now, what issues particularly has the board been discussing getting outside counsel on?
They're concerned about what information from the complaint and the complaint process can be released to the public.
There's been a long-standing concern of mine. I mean, I understand you file a complaint with the Citizens Police Review Board, and then suddenly the police department stamps secret and confidential on it, and nobody can see it. At least that has been the case for the last year, more or less, has it not?
That's not quite accurate. The complainant can always release their copy of the complaint to the public and press.
But they cannot ask you to keep a copy in their office that's open to the public,
correct? That is correct.
And that's very strange, you know. Why can't they? Why can't they simply leave a complaint with you and say, here, send one to the police stations, surely, but also leave one on file for those other people who need to know that such a thing is being filed. It took me 5 years to get it together, to have the courage to file this complaint, or let's say, I guess it wouldn't be 5 years because it's you have the statute of limitations, but it took me a certain amount of courage to get it together to do this. Now I want the public to know it, and I don't want to have to throw a press conference to do it.
Right.
I guess the reason has to do with the police complaint form, and now that becomes an official police document or some double talk like that?
Well, the reasoning is, the legal reasoning that we've been told is that the complaint form that the complainant fills out opens the internal affairs investigation and therefore is part of the internal affairs investigation file.
And the internal affairs investigation, we should say, is what takes place inside the actual police department. You don't do that. That's what the police department is at, like the fox watching the chicken coop, does its own investigation of itself, right?
Correct.
Okay.
And the board reviews that investigation. So anyway, the complaint form, because it is the document that starts the whole investigation, is a confidential document because it is attached to the internal affairs files. That is the legal opinion of the city attorney, and that is what we're bound by at this point.
Well, could an individual go in, file a complaint, which would then become part of the confidential file of the police department, and then file a second copy of that complaint with you and say, I'd like you to keep this in an open file?
The city attorney has advised us that it's the document itself that is confidential, the document and the contents. So unless the form is altered by perhaps the police department, I'm not sure on this, that even if we get a copy of it, is still a confidential document.
Well, suppose they filed the original complaint with you or with the police department, and then they came in and took a copy of that complaint and simply struck out the top line or something. They altered it in some way and said, "This is my public copy of this complaint, and I wish to file it with you for the information of those who want to know that complaints are being filed, and this is that. This is not the same. This is not exactly the same. this is a copy, and I'd like you to put that in an open file. Mm-hmm. Would you be able to do that?
I don't know. I would have to check with the city attorney. I mean, I'm not a lawyer.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
You do have numerous documents that are open to the public.
Yes.
And one would assume, I mean, I know, for example, that I've given you different flyers that you keep in a folder that's open to the public, in essence. So it would seem to me that you are burdening, or at least the city attorney is burdening, I don't want to blame you, burdening the complainant who comes in with a complaint against the police department and wants that complaint known. And it seems to me there has to be a process by which that can be done, which sidesteps this clearly politically motivated attempt to sequester complaints by the police department. And I guess I would always love to see your board in a kind of proactive way trying to do things like this, to expand the public's access.
Well, Robert, let me tell you that the board has expanded the Complaint Tracking Process Committee.
Mm-hmm.
It is a committee now of Kay Bowden, Michael Hernandez, and John Malkin, and their charge is to look into what information can be made public.
When is the next meeting of that committee?
I have not been informed when the committee is meeting, but this is one of the issues, this is the issue that they're looking into, and if you have specific ideas about...
Or if any member of the public does.
Or any member of the public, right, about how we can address this issue, it would be very important to get that information to that committee.
Uh-huh. You have a phone number people can call to leave information with that committee?
They should call the office here at 429-3262, and we'll have the latest information as to when the committee is meeting and where.
And I should add that you can be reached at this number between 9 and 1 Monday through Thursday, right?
Correct.
And that your office does accept complaints, and you will assist people in filling them out if they have a problem with any sworn Santa Cruz City police officer.
Yes.
Of course, my problem with the endless process of committee meetings that your board has been engaged in for the last 13 months is that it seems painfully slow, and it also seems that Police Officers Association seems to be kind of cutting you off at the pass at every turn. Police Officers Association, for those people who are listening, is the union for the police department, which it protects the rights and privacy and job security, I would assume, of the police department. But they've also been attempting to, as I understand it, and I want to state it fairly, to limit the powers of the Citizens Police Review Board, even to the extent of, what would you say about that? How would you describe that?
I would say that the Police Officers Association was never in favor of a Citizens Police Review Board, and that continues today.
Mm-hmm. And let us say that the kinds of concerns and objections they've raised have been like what?
Their main concern is police officers' confidentiality. They're an association of the police officers. They want to protect the rights of their officers as they see those rights, and that's their main concern with this public board, is that that confidentiality is not breached.
So in this case, what that means is stamping secret and confidential on every complaint that comes into the police department, so that the public essentially is denied access to those complaints, or at least to the names of the officers who are being complained against, unless an individual who is filing a complaint wishes to take the expense, trouble, and risk of holding a press conference.
That's about it, because there are specific state laws that pertain to personnel actions, and that's what we're bound by.
In fact, hasn't the POA also attempted to interfere with or limit the access of the board itself to these complaints? I understand for a while you guys had to troop over to the police station and read the complaints under armed guard, or one might say having the police archive officer there while you read the actual complaint. They would not send you copies of the complaint until I think you negotiated that months later, and they're still telling you that you need some kind of a $1,000 safe in the office to make sure that activists don't break in and read the complaints that they could get by simply talking to the complainant? Am I being fair here in saying this?
No, there are several inaccuracies there, Robert.
Please clarify my inaccuracies.
Initially, the board did have to do their reviews at the police department. The police were not making copies of the original internal affairs investigation file. The internal affairs officer was not present in the room while the board members deliberated on a particular complaint, but they were in the building because they are the custodian of that particular file. So they did need to be there. They couldn't just give us the file and say, okay, do what you want to do.
Uh-huh.
And I don't really remember the reason right now why initially we weren't getting why it wasn't being copied.
And there'll be more police department shenanigans at my next show. That's going to be Monday, 10 o'clock. And you'll be there, 96.3 FM. Free Radio Santa Cruz. If you want to be on the show, be at 9:45 at Taco Bell in downtown Santa Cruz at Laurel and Pacific, or give me a call over the weekend at 423-HUFF-4833. I apologize to Brimstone Barb Riverwoman, to John Malkin, and to Coral Broom for not playing what I hoped I could fit in time for, and I think we'll probably be repeating this segment of the Citizens Police Review Board interview with Gary Yamane, a very interesting exchange. I want to thank you for being with me, and I want to invite you to listen to the next hour with Battling Bob LaMonica on the usual horseshit around the DA's office. Go at it, Bob.